Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 21. If Joe wanted a lesson on real approach avoidance conflict, Callie could have given him one that afternoon. She approached the two packages she'd placed on Billy's desk no less than 5 times, only to retreat to get a cup of tea or perform some other inane task. Had only the one from Billy awaited her, she would have opened it immediately. But the sight of Bernice's flowery handwriting on the other stunned her. How many times had Billy reminded her not to forget to clean out the toy box? How many times had she thought he wanted her to clean out the mess in her mind? Eventually, though, curiosity overrode apprehension, and she opened the package from Billy. Inside, she found a large photo album filled with pictures of her and the cats, beginning with that first day when she arrived at the granary in all of her greenish-yellow glory. Billy had captured so many special moments she'd missed that she felt as if the two of them had lived in parallel universes. While she concentrated on what the cats said about and meant to her, he simply enjoyed them. Sections devoted to each cat included an individual portrait, followed by pictures of that animal at work, at play, and at rest. After studying each of these carefully, she spent an especially long time looking at the album's final picture, one of her sprawled on the living room floor, laughing and covered with cats. For the first time in weeks, she allowed herself to remember the sound and feel of the warm, purring cocoon they made for her. For the first time in weeks, she allowed herself to weep for the loss of the most perfect friends, both human and animal, she had ever known. Then she picked up the second package, put it down again, and told herself she needed another cup of tea. The second package also contained a photo album, but a smaller one with just one print per page. The first picture showed her parents' old camera with its time-release cable dangling and the rickety old tripod they'd used when they briefly experimented with taking pictures of themselves in the 60s. The camera and tripod stood in the Shackelfords' backyard next to a folding card table on which several disposable cameras were neatly aligned. Next came a photo of Bernice and Howard, with Billy standing between them. Evidently, her parents wanted her to know that either they or Billy had taken all of the pictures to follow. The third picture showed Bernice and Billy making brownies in the kitchen. Billy held the bowl and wore a whisk, while Bernice posed theatrically with a box of brownie mix in one hand and her spatula in a plastic bag filled with what looked like dry grass clippings in the other. "Oh, no," Callie groaned curly as visions of the three of them in the tub covered with dream whip filled her mind. "They got Billy stoned and they took pictures of it." In reality, though, the next picture showed a second, larger folding table in the backyard, this one decorated with a festive paper cloth, streamers and balloons, plus a plate filled with the now-baked brownies and 2 bottles of wine. Callie's parents and Billy all hoisted their wine glasses cheerfully in her direction. In the following pictures, only half a bottle of wine and half of the brownies remained, and Billy removed clothing from a large box on the lawn next to the table. Garments of all sorts lay neatly on the ground around him. In the sixth picture, he held a familiar, frilly dressing gown up to Howard, who now wore a bright orange wig and hiking boots and smiled bravely. In the photo after that, Billy shyly handed an old tuxedo and brass bra to Bernice, who leaned precariously against the table on her spiked heels. In the one after that, Howard and Bernice posed somewhat uncomfortably in the complete outfits Billy had chosen for them. The next photo showed 2 empty wine bottles, the addition of a third, no brownies on the plate, and Howard and Bernice looking much happier in their new outfits. In this one, Howard attached a rubber hose to the exhaust pipe of the car while Bernice held a roll of duct tape. The following pictures of Howard and Bernice sitting in their old, hand-painted car in their bizarre costumes reminded Callie of a childhood poem. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money, wrapped up in a 5-pound note. In each of a succession of pictures of them in the car, Howard and Bernice wore different expressions, from the most sublime to the most grotesque, with a few comical ones and one quite touching one. In the latter, Howard looked up with his mouth open wide as if singing, while Bernice worshipped him adoringly. The owl looked up at the stars above and sang to a small guitar, "Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love, what a beautiful pussy you are." Then came the grand finale. It began with a picture of Howard, Bernice, and Billy painting banners on the long table now cleared of party food, followed by one of Bernice and Howard holding up a banner as they stood in front of their car. "Goodbye, Callie," it said in multicolored capital letters decorated with Billy's distinctive animals and flowers. Next, Howard and Bernice sat in the car again, holding a second banner to the side as they waved to her. On this one she read, "Don't be afraid." In the final picture, they held a third banner to the side of the car while Billy stood beside them in his chef's hat and Superman cape, beaming and waving. The final banner read, "We all love you very much." So what if her parents weren't normal people? In their own way, they were good ones. Callie didn't know how many times she went through the two albums, first in Billy's room and then again in the kitchen with another cup of tea. When Joe came back for Curly, she made him sit down and went through both albums again with him too, beginning with the one of the cats. "This is Bernice and this is Howard," she told him, pointing to the two cats sitting on the windowsill in the picture. "I thought Bernice and Howard were your parents," he replied. "They were, but I named the cats after them. Well, I actually named two cats after my mother, Bernice and Venus, because she had two names." "Did you name your other cats after people, too?" he asked. "I thought it would help me come to terms with my feelings about them," she admitted. "Oh." She expected to hear pity in his voice when he said that, but she didn't. As she went through the album, Callie told him not only about each of the cats, but also about the people who shared their names. "It must have been pretty rough when they all died at once like that," he remarked when she finished. She nodded and picked up the second album and handed it to him. "Here, this might tie up a few loose ends for you, too." He went through the book slowly, page by page, then went through it again, all without saying a word. They planned it that way so Billy wouldn't be afraid when he found them. He finally announced after he studied the final picture for a second time, "And they wanted you to know that, only Billy forgot to give this to you when he got sick. That's the way I see it." And then, perhaps because Callie had shared so much with him, Joe told her about his laughing daughter and stubborn mother, both of whom he so desperately wanted to save, but couldn't. "Sometimes we fail others, Callie," he concluded, "no matter how much we love them or how hard we try." He handed the album back to her. "Your parents were good people." Joe studied her as if daring her to doubt this. "You do know that, don't you?" She nodded and automatically signed, "Yes, I do." During the next few weeks, Callie gave a lot of thought to how much time she had spent blowing things out of proportion, worrying rather than enjoying as Billy had, and she vowed to change. In time, she also came to accept that she could happily work with animals and do this very well. She just couldn't have any of her own. Thanks to the album from her parents, her mental image of Billy finding their bodies no longer dwarfed everyone and everything around her. Thanks to it and them, she was almost at peace for the first time in her life and ready to move on. To that end, she hired a contractor to convert Penn's lean-to to a veterinary practice. For the most part, the weather reflected her mood. A few storms, but nothing she couldn't handle or that kept her from doing anything she really wanted to do. The day the forecast for the season's first nor'easter, complete with gale-force winds and 3-foot snowfall, made the news, she felt ready for it. Callie spent that day at Penn's overseeing the installation of some new equipment in what would soon become the surgery of her new practice. By the time she left, it had grown dark, and the thick, heavy snowflakes were beginning to fall at a rapidly accelerating rate. Soon the visibility became so limited that she slowed the van to a crawl. That same day, Joe worked in an area of his woodlot that the predicted snow would make inaccessible. As he drove home in the storm that evening, he saw the car ahead of him slow on the bridge crossing the swamp. At first he thought the road conditions precipitated the response, but then he saw the driver hurl something into the water below. He swore heavily and angrily flashed his headlights and laid on the horn. A combination of activities that caused the car to move off at an unsafe speed and Joe almost to lose control of his truck. Once on the bridge, Joe jumped out of the truck and ran to the bank overlooking a small patch of still open water. He shined his flashlight on it and saw something small and white in the murky depths. "Damn it to hell," he exploded to Curly. "It's a fucking cat." He wanted to say, "It's only a fucking cat," and to leave it because it was bound to be dead, and because he didn't try to save anything anymore. As Callie approached the swamp from the opposite direction, she saw one vehicle veering down a side road near the bridge and another stopped on it. As she drew closer, she could see Joe's truck with the driver's door open and Curly frolicking in the snow beside it. Surprise caused her to depress the brake pedal harder than she intended, and the van skidded to a stop less than 2 feet from Joe's plow. "Joe!" The wind ripped his name out of her mouth as she ran from the van. "Where are you?" "Over here," he shouted from somewhere down the embankment. She raced to the side of the road and saw him standing in the ice-skimmed water holding something in his arms. "What are you doing?" she shouted again. "What the hell does it look like I'm doing?" he bellowed. "I'm standing in a swamp, freezing my ass off, holding a drowned cat." He slogged out of the water and thrust the limp body at her. "Here, save him." She shrank back, arms rigid at her side and hands balled into fists, suddenly paralyzed by the memory of all those cats. "Save him," Joe repeated. "You have to." "Joe, I can't. I did my part," he interrupted her. "It's your turn now." Still, she stood there looking at him. "Callie, they don't always have to die." His words, chosen to assure her, penetrated the barriers that both of them had built to protect themselves. She shed her parka, wrapped the cat in it, and ran to the van. Once sheltered from the snow and bitter wind, she put her mouth over his nose and mouth and began to breathe into him. "How long ago did this happen?" she asked between breaths. "Just a minute or so before you got here. Some no-mind slowed down just long enough to toss him, then took off. He going to be all right?" The cat retched in Callie's face, a good indicator that he felt capable of taking at least a few breaths on his own. "Maybe, if I can get him warmed up." Noticing Joe's soaking wet clothing and his shivering, she added, "For God's sake, Joe, get out of the cold before you freeze to death." "I can't. Your van's in the way." "Go to my place. It's closer," she ordered him. "I'll be there as soon as I'm sure the cat can travel." All the way to Calais, Joe's mind spun with doubts about what he had done. When he plunged into the icy water and pulled out the cat, he felt a tremendous rush. He'd saved him. But in those few seconds between that and Calais' arrival, he realized how seductive the concept of salvation was. Anyone could play hero because it felt so good. But then what? What if the cat died anyway? Or what if he had permanent brain damage or other problems? Even if the cat survived in perfect health, how could Callie not want to control and protect him? Not so much because this would be the best thing for the cat, although that's what she'd tell herself, but because it would be the best thing for her. When Callie began addressing the then-what aspects of his heroic gesture, he realized how greatly he had erred when he had handed her the cat, saying he'd done his part. He should have said, "I did the easy part." Breathing into an animal, having it puke all over you, doing all the right things, maybe for hours, days, months, or the rest of the animal's life, choosing to become involved to that degree without expecting the animal to be what you want rather than what it is, that was the difficult part. He couldn't have done that, not even for something. No, not even for someone he loved. Especially not for someone he loved. His mother had tried to tell him that when she was dying, but he was too caught up in his hero fantasies to listen. As he thought about Callie working on that cat, Joe could see the wisdom in his mother's choice not to put either herself or him through that. And for the first time since it happened, he saw beyond his failure to save his daughter and into the then-what realm of what she would have suffered after all that time in the water. Isolated by the snow as he drove to Callie's, he articulated the truth he had run away from all these years. He could easily have handled the rush of heroism, but he could not have dealt with the consequences. Rather than feeling like even more of a failure, Joe felt the peace that comes from knowing the truth, even a truth you don't particularly want to know. For the first time in weeks, he took a deep, unrestricted breath and slowly let it out. When he reached the driveway to the farm, he dropped the plow and cleared the way for Callie. By the time Callie convinced herself the cat could breathe on his own, a thick blanket of snow covered the van and almost obliterated Joe's tire tracks. She tucked the animal inside her shirt, put on her wet parka, and inched her way home in near whiteout conditions, following the rapidly disappearing remnants of Joe's trail. Nor did she feel the least bit put out to discover that he had plowed a path for her. As she got closer, she noticed that no lights illuminated her home. "The power's out," she told the cat. Not a surprising event, considering the weather. After she parked the van and began walking toward the house, she could see the glow of a kerosene lamp on the kitchen table, and the scent of wood smoke told her Joe had built up the fire and probably sat in front of the wood stove drying out. Once inside, she picked up the lamp and went into the former cat room, where she placed the animal on a table to examine him more thoroughly. "How's he doing?" Joe appeared in the doorway, wrapped in the down comforter from her bed, holding a bottle of wine and two glasses in one hand and a flashlight in the other, like a modern-day Bacchus accompanied by his faithful hound. "So well I can hardly believe it," she replied, nudging Curly's pointy nose out of the way as she examined the cat. "Aside from being a little wet and chilled, he appears in remarkably good shape." "Glad to hear I didn't put my life on the line for nothing," Joe teased her to cover his relief, then added, "Oh, pardon me." "Pardon you for what?" "Not you. I was talking to this pathetic excuse for a plant." He stepped aside to reveal the rubber tree, which admittedly did look pretty pathetic in its current leafless state, but a new leaf was beginning to grow. Callie was about to explain the plant's history and miraculous recovery when he added, "I accidentally bumped into it and wasn't sure if it was one of your long-lost relatives or old boyfriends." "I thought you were freezing to death," she sniffed, picking up the cat. "Why aren't you in front of the stove?" "Curly and I just couldn't miss an opportunity to see what you were up to," he replied, trailing her comforter on the floor as he and his dog followed her and the cat into the living room. Callie made a nest for the cat next to the stove using her old barn coat and tucked him in the center of it. No sooner had she done this than Curly rearranged the garment and then the cat so he could fit on the coat too. When the cat tried to wriggle away, Curly pulled him back, lightly pinned him with a lanky leg, and began grooming him. At first the cat resisted, but Curly persisted and soon the cat purred contentedly. "Just like Nana," Callie told Joe, who lay propped up on one arm beneath a stack of blankets in front of the stove. From the way he'd arranged them, he made it quite clear that she could either join him or freeze to death. "When you were cold, I took pity on you and warmed you up," he reminded her, in case she had any doubts. "If you cared about me, you'd help me, too." Unsure whether caring about him was a good idea, Callie looked down at the cat vomit on her wet shirt. "Given the way this shirt looks and smells," she replied, matching the same light tone, "probably anything's better than wearing it." Callie sat down on the wide pine floorboards to watch the white cat meticulously removing the last muddy residue from the delicate hair between his toes as she undressed in the flickering light of the kerosene lamp. While she pulled off her boots and heavy woolen socks, she commented on the spare economy and elegance of his behavior. After she shed her flannel-lined jeans, she knelt beside him and viewed him from different angles, pondering how she could capture those qualities on film. By the time she leaned back and began unbuttoning her blouse, she had magnified her mental image of the cat until it became one that embodied the essence of elemental grace and purity, an image that reminded her of Billy. "I know," she announced to the cat. "I'll call you Bill... Callie?" The tone of Joe's voice made her look at him, and what she saw made her freeze. Instead of the half-teasing, half-seductive expression he wore when he invited her to join him under the blankets, he now gazed at her with an intensity she had never seen in him before. But more than that, he held up one work-hardened, slightly trembling hand, palm and fingers facing her, fingers held tightly together. If I can do it, you can do it, he challenged her softly, extending his hand toward her kneeling form. I don't know what... She wanted to say, I don't know what you mean, but of course she did. She tore her eyes away from his and looked at the cat again, the cat the two of them had saved, the cat who, she now realized, had given them the chance to save themselves. This time she did not see a wondrous symbol of Billy Paradise. This time she saw something even more miraculous. She saw a wondrously normal cat displaying splendidly normal feline behaviors. She saw the cat as he was, the way Billy Paradise would have seen him. Turning back to Joe, Callie slowly at first, but then with increased determination, reached out and placed her smaller, also trembling but equally strong hand against his. For a moment they remained like that, palm to palm and fingers to fingers in the golden light. And then, while the cat licked the last bit of mud from his paw, oblivious to the drama beside him, Callie and Joe slowly spread their fingers and let go. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.